Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in again. I'm still battling my cold from last week, so apologies if I sound like a snot monster rat in your ears. I will get this intro over quickly for you. So this week we've got Gilby Clark from, Guns N' Roses, Heart, MC5, Rockstar Supernova. He's done everything and he's super cool and he's coming to Australia soon. Then we've got Derek Sheridan, the keyboard legend, to talk about Sons of Apollo, his new supergroup. Then finally we've got Lindy Ortega, who is a great kind of country-influenced artist who does really sweet finger-picking kind of stuff, and she's also coming out here to Australia soon for a run of shows, including the Queenscliff Music Festival. Don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, share the episodes if you like them. It's the only way this thing is going to grow, and it's doing pretty well so far, but I would like to kind of take over the world with this thing. If you head on over to patreon.com/iHeartGuitar, you can chuck in a few bucks to support the podcast and the blog, and get access to an exclusive subscriber feed that has songs that I've recorded or extended interviews I've done, and that's going to start really kicking in with extra content like reviews and roundtable chats and stuff soon. Otherwise, let's get into the episode. So Gilby Clark is coming to Australia for some intimate shows in November and December. He's hitting up Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane and Canberra, my old stomping ground. He'll be at Crowbar in Brisbane on Thursday, November 30. Cherry Bar in Melbourne on Friday, December 1, The Basement in Canberra on Saturday, December 2, and at Frankie's in Sydney on Sunday, 3rd of December. You can get tickets now from hardlinemedia.net. So here we go, Mr. Gilby Clark.
I'm stoked about this Australian tour, and looking at the list of dates, you're playing some really, it's the perfect venues for what you do. It's like rock clubs with a lot of vibe, you know?
Great. You know, that's always good to hear because, you know, for the international shows, you know, we never know what we're going to get. And, you know, you meet people after the show and they always say, oh, man, this is a great venue, but you should have played this one. So it's good to know that these are the right ones.
Yeah, no, you're going to love it. Frankie's Pizza and the Cherry Bar. Yeah, some great places.
That's good. Rock and roll should be in dirty bars. That's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, definitely. So what kind of material can we expect? You've got such a discography. There's heaps of stuff to choose from.
Yeah, I do. You know, what I do is it's mainly stuff from, my solo records, you know, but I also do, you know, obviously, you know, we throw in a couple GNR cuts. I do, a Slash the Snake Pit cut, MC5, Stones, Beatles, David Bowie, a little bit of everything, you know. We just try to... It's mainly stuff that inspires me, you know, as an artist, a guitarist, a singer, a songwriter, just get that opportunity to, just hear the things that inspires me.
Well, it's interesting because what I've always felt you've brought to the bands you've joined is it's like you're an ambassador for rock, you know?
Well, thank you for noticing. You know, it's funny because people can always say, how do you do Nancy Sinatra and the MC5 in the same year? I go, well, what's funny is, I don't change much. I am what I am, and after, I'm not Steve Vai, I'm not Slash, I'm not Zach, but I am a rock and roll guitar player, and I still play a Les Paul through a Marshall with Nancy Sinatra as I do with the MC5 and as I did with GNR. It's just picking the right projects. With Nancy, she's got a really broad scope of music. She's got this, 60s rock stuff, but then she has some jazz stuff too, which, is really challenging, but it still comes from, look, guitar is blues, man. No matter what, with the exception of some of the modern stuff that's out, it really starts from the blues, and all the rock stuff is blues, and that's what most of us guitar players are anyway.
Yeah. Do you, I was thinking about this for myself recently. Do you remember when you first heard the blues?
Do I remember? That's an interesting question. Let me think about that for a second. When was the first time that I heard the blues? I got to tell you, I think the first time that I heard it, and I probably didn't know that it was the blues, was B.B. King. Yeah. When I was young, I mean, some of us had big brothers, some of us had our parents' record collection, or some of us had friends and stuff. And, you know, the first records that I ever saw was, my parents were really young. My mother was 19 years old when she had me. So, you know, she was still coming out of her teenage years. So she did have a couple B.B. King records. And I heard them by default. Like, I didn't put them on. They were playing them. And I didn't know that that was blues. I just thought that that was pop music at that time. You know, what really caught my attention was in Cleveland, Ohio, there were a couple blues bars and stuff. And, you know, you go sneak in when you're not old enough and you watch the bands play and the guitar players play. And that's where, like, it really kind of caught me is, you know, in hearing all the guitar players that I loved, you know, talk about, you know, where that came from.
Yeah. Sweet.
Very long answer.
No, perfect answer. So what are your current guitar gear obsessions?
I'm sorry, say it again?
Your current guitar obsessions. You know,
what is my current guitar obsession? Well, you know what? I'm actually recording a new solo record right now. I'm pretty much finished recording it, and I'm in the mixing stages. So I've been playing with pedals, guitar pedals. You know, there's so many unique devices out there these days, and there's so much great stuff being made that, I mean, even in the distortion department, I never knew that they could have so many pedals that did distortion and delay. So that's kind of been my obsession, is playing with pedals, man. I've been having a lot of fun on this record of just tweaking with different fuzz pedals and different delay pedals and, you know, just you know, kind of learning a little bit about them. I mean, back in the GNR tour, I only had one pedal. I had a chorus pedal, and it wasn't even underneath me. I mean, I never used pedals up until, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and I still only have, like, three.
It's funny. When I got my very first electric guitar, I had an amp that only had a volume and a tone control, and it was solid state. There was no distortion. So for the first 6 months of playing electric, I just had a clean sound, and it sucked. And then my dad got me a distortion pedal for my birthday. And I remember stepping on it for the very first time and my mom screaming from the kitchen, "What the fuck is that?" And I was like, that's
there
my
you
future.
Go. You know, what's funny is I have the same amp that I had in my very first band, like my first real band that like got a record deal and everything. I bought a little brown Fender Deluxe. And I had read about that it was the amp that Ted Nugent used for, like, Cat Scratch Fever and Stranglehold, which, you know, was always the greatest guitar sound. And I bought it for, like, $200 back then. And in my first band, I used that little Deluxe, like, at the smaller gigs, you know, because most of the time I'd use a Marshall and stuff. But over the years, it just has a volume and tone. I mean, there's two channels, but that's it. And to this day, on every record I've ever made, even the GNR record and stuff, I always use this Fender Deluxe as my sound. Like, everybody thinks it's a Marshall, but it's really an old Fender Deluxe.
Yeah. You know, speaking of your earlier bands, I went back and listened to Kill for Thrills before doing this interview, and man, you guys had something really cool going on.
Thank you. You know what's strange about Kill for Thrills was, that was the first band that I was ever a singer in. You know, I've always been a guitar player. And when we started Kill for Thrills, it was, you know, metal was taking over L.A. at that point. And none of my friends actually liked metal. Like, I never liked metal. You know, I was always like a rock guy, but not a metal guy. And so there was a clique of us. And when we started Kill for Thrills, it was really just to kind of be a rock band. Like, we just wanted to be the band that we've always wanted to hear. And we tried out singers, we tried out different people, and the guys kept saying, you know, Gilby, you're a better singer than all the singers that we've tried out. And I go, yeah, but I don't want to be the singer. It's like getting demoted or something. And so anyway, that was my first band singing in. And it really kind of, I mean, when you hear the record, I mean, you know, my vocals are kind of all over the place, you know, because they're different keys and stuff. I didn't know about singing. But I also think that innocence, you know, and that naive is kind of what made it kind of unique, you know, for what it is. You know, I mean, it's definitely a rock record, but I hear it every now and then and kind of go, wow, you know, it's not so bad. And it's still, you know, I mean, you can put that record out today and it doesn't sound like it's 1988.
Yeah.
A lot of those records during those periods, you know, really sound like that date, you know?
Yeah, it's really funny, actually. I've noticed that you put on something like Def Leppard's Hysteria now, and I know throughout all the 90s, that album sounded really like old-fashioned and 80s to me. It was so like synthetic sounding. You put it on now, and it sounds like anything else that's been released this year, you know, because everything's got that kind of polished sheen. They're just doing it a different way.
It's true. You're right. I mean, listen to any country record, and they sound like a Def Leppard record now.
So what guitars are you using at the moment?
I'm still a Les Paul guy. I mean, I'm still like, I always use that, it's called a classic 60s Les Paul. But I still play Zamatis. Zamatis is a guitar from an old English guitar maker, like Ron Wood, Keith Richards used to use them, and George Harrison. It was an English thing. And I had one like back in the GNR days. He actually made me a couple of them. And a Japanese bought them out, and they've been making them for like the last like maybe 15 years. So it's just basically like a Les Paul, really. It's all it is, just maybe a different design of it, you know. But still use Les Paul Telecaster, you know, like a regular old Telecaster for, you know, when I'm doing like a little of the, you know, rootsier stuff, the stonesier stuff, I use that. But really nothing has changed pretty much, but Les Paul, Zamatis, and Telecaster is pretty much what I pull out when I'm doing my fly dates and stuff.
I imagine you have a bit of a collection, though, of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I'm not a collector, but I definitely have like probably about 80 guitars at this point. I mean, I do have some nice ones. Like I got a 59 Strat. I got a 59 Junior. I mean, I don't have a 59 Les Paul or anything, but I have a really nice 69. Kelly thin line that really looks brand new, you know, that's nice. And I got a 68 Tele. I guess I got a lot of older Telecasters, but the Les Pauls, I have a lot of like Les Paul classics. You know, they're all like black and gold for some reason. I only have like one or two Sunburst, you know, but I've been actually having a little fun with Instagram. You know, I've never been like a Facebook guy or anything, but I've been having fun with Instagram, and I noticed that, like, if I'm in a studio and I take a picture of a guitar, I get some really nice responses from some of my friends, you know, that I don't really talk to so much all the time, but they're like, oh, man, I remember that guitar. I remember when you got that guitar. And having Instagram has actually kind of been fun for that, of, you know, playing with, you know, your different guitars and different amps and different toys and stuff with all your friends.
Yeah. So when can we expect a new record? And are you going to be playing stuff from it in Australia?
I'm not going to play anything from the new record, and the main reason is because I don't really want it out until it's out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nowadays with YouTube and all that stuff, I mean, I just, you know, what little excitement you have from a new record coming out, it can really get killed, you know, by playing it live. So I decided not to play it live until it's done. The record is done. Like I said, I'm in the kind of the final mixing stages, so we haven't got a release date yet, but it's definitely after the first year. But I hope it's not any later than spring, because it's done and it's ready to roll.
Yeah. You know, I miss the days when I didn't know what records were coming out until I went to the new releases section at the record store, and it was like, holy crap, what's this?
I know. I always tell a funny story about that, of when I was a kid and I first got into like Kiss and Zeppelin and stuff. And Kiss had started getting popular, and I went to the record store, and I go, oh, my God, Kiss has a new record out. Oh, my God, it's a three-record set. It was called Kiss the Originals, and basically what they did was they re-released their first three records because they were you know, the live record made them popular. Mm. Well, when I got the thing home, I went, wait a minute, I already have these three records. They just repackaged them, but they got me. <You
know? laughs> And that was the first time Gene got the audience and not the last.
Exactly. I always laugh about that. I go, I got it home. I go, wait a minute, I already have all these records. You know, back then we didn't know, like you said, that excitement of going to the store and seeing the record. I didn't ask any questions. I just grabbed it and went right to the counter, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, that looks like our time up. So thanks for a great chat. It's been really cool to finally talk in person instead of email. So,
Great. Well, yeah. And if you do get a chance to go to one of the shows, definitely come up and reintroduce yourself to me just so we can catch up.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, great, man. Have a good time.
You too. See ya.
Now, Derek Sherinian was one of the very first people I interviewed for I Hard Guitar when it started 10 years ago. As a keyboard player, he's one of the greatest guitarists you'll ever hear. He has a real understanding of how a guitarist plays, and I think that's what's made him such a great fit in bands like Dream Theater, Alice Cooper, Black Country Communion, his own band Planet X. And now he's in the supergroup Sons of Apollo with Mike Portnoy, Billy Sheehan, Bumblefoot, and Jeff Scott Soto. Their debut record, Psychotic Symphony, is out now, and it's really kick-ass. So here's Derek.
So I've been listening to the record. In fact, when I got the email yesterday asking if I wanted to do the interview, I was in the middle of listening to the record. I know you guys have been on a big press tour, and you must have been talking about this a hell of a lot over the last few weeks, but how do you feel about it now that you can kind of step back and listen to the record and it's been out for a week? You know, what are your feelings?
We knew right away after we finished this record that we made something special, and we've been sitting on it now for like 3 months. The last Friday the record came out to the world, and we're seeing such an overwhelmingly awesome response from all of our old fans. We're seeing a lot of new fans that are joining, and what's really exciting is that this is a brand new, fresh thing, and a lot of these fans are coming in on the ground floor, and you can feel that that's a special thing, and we're all in this together, and everyone that's involved with Sons of Apollo feels the buzz and the juice, and we know that this is going to explode worldwide. Everyone can't be wrong, and you can just see the look on all the journalists' faces. I mean, I've done probably 500 interviews, either face-to-face or phoners, and everyone has the same enthusiasm on our record, Psychotic Symphony. It's just, there's not another band out right now that plays like this.
Yeah, well, I remember when the video for Coming Home came out, a few people were like, oh, it's not very prog, it's just straight ahead hard rock. And my thought was, well, wait until you hear the rest, because these guys, there's going to be some prog in here.
That's the thing, you know, and we, you know, that's when we first put this together, Mike and I, we figured it was going to be more prog metal like stuff we've done in the past. But once we started writing, all of our classic rock and hard rock influence came to the forefront, and the virtuosity was more like icing on the cake. So we mastered the art of strategic wankery. We put the songs first. We want to make sure that this stuff is fucking kick-ass rock and roll, like the stuff that we grew up on. AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, Aerosmith, Van Halen, Queen, Kiss, you know, all of those great bands. The Who, you can hear little parts of all of those bands in Sons of Apollo. You can also hear some of the most sick instrumental musical passages that you've ever heard before, but that's not what this band is all about. Again, it's strategic wankery, the songs come first.
Yeah, well, I was curious because you've worked with Billy and Mike before. What was it like kind of learning to work musically with, you know, Bumblefoot, with Jeff?
Well, I mean, Mike and I are the producers of the record, so they kind of had to learn to work with us.
Yeah.
But we figured it out, though, man. I mean, we all just kind of have the chemistry, and all of us just have the same common goal of we all love the same bands, and we all work really hard, and we all just kind of tuned into each other's frequency, and we made a great record.
So in terms of songwriting for something like this, it's obviously not simple stuff. How do you do it? Does one person kind of come in with some stuff and say, learn it? Or is it a collaborative effort? And when do you find time to do it with all the stuff you guys do?
Well, when Mike called me and asked me if I was ready to go forward with this, I immediately went in the studio and I started demoing song ideas and riffs and different things that I thought would be great for Sons of Apollo, and I just kept writing and writing, and then Bumblefoot did the same thing, and we were sending each other stuff over the email, and by the time we got in the studio April 1st, we had, you know, a ton of riffs to go through, and we just started listening down, and what was amazing is that most of the stuff I demoed, I'd say 80% of it ended up on the record. One of the first things that I wrote was an 11-minute piece called God of the Sun. That's a trilogy. And I sent it to Mike, and right away he heard it, and it was a very raw demo, but he said, he goes, this is amazing. He goes, it's we'll leave it exactly as it is, and this should be the opening of the record. And I said, Mike, I go, we haven't even written the whole record yet. I go, this is just a demo. He goes, I already know it. And I go, wow, okay, we'll see. And here we are, and there it is at the front of the record. So I was very happy about that.
Yeah. Let's talk equipment. Now, I'm primarily a guitarist, but I've been getting way into keyboards lately, which for me pretty much means a whole bunch of plugins and stuff because I can afford those. I can't afford a room full of actual keyboards. What are you using?
I use everything but plugins.
Yeah.
I use real keyboards, Hammond B3. I use a Mellotron. I use Nord synthesizers going through Marshall stacks. I am very, I'm old school, but I have some modern gear as well, but I don't use any trickery as far as apps or sequencing or playback tapes or stuff like that. Everything is very live and real.
Yeah.
And I go through guitar pedals, a lot of things as well, too.
Well, last time we talked, which was like 10 years ago, we talked a bit about how guitarists have influenced your style. Has there been anything in the last 10 years, either in guitar gear or players, that have kind of shaped you a certain way?
You know, I listen to the same stuff that I listened to since I was 14, pretty much. Yngwie, Ed Van Halen, Randy Rhoads, Holdsworth, Jeff Beck, all the same guys. There really hasn't been anyone new that has come around in the last, you know, 25 years or whatever that has really done anything.
Yeah.
Except Bumblefoot. And you gotta hear how this fucking guy plays. He's like, I'll say this, and I'm not saying this in a braggadocious way, but it's a fact. I played with the very best guitarist in the world. I just recently did the Generation X tour with Steve Vai, Yngwie, and Zakk Wylde, and all of these guys are fantastic players, but Bumblefoot is something special. It's very rare when you find a guy that has super strong rock and roll background that has the virtuosity that can play anything. And Bumblefoot is the perfect hybrid. And that's what Sons of Apollo, that's one thing that we all have in common. We're all rock musicians and we rock hard, but we're all virtuosos at the same time. And so we blend those two things, but it always comes from a place of rock first.
Yeah.
And that's what separates Sons of Apollo from all the other bands on the planet, is that most rock bands do not have the chops that we do, and most prog bands don't have the swagger that we do. And
yeah.
So that's what makes us special.
Yeah. I really dig the way your sound and Bumblefoot's fits together. Like, he has this kind of mid-rangey, like, very kind of rounded sound, and you're kind of supplying some, like, some more air in the top end over the, you know, over the top of that, and it just really sounds like a massive instrument.
It does. And also add in there Billy Sheehan. All of us, I mean, I play keyboards like a guitar player. Billy Sheehan plays bass like a guitar player. And Bumblefoot plays like a guitar player. So it's like this three-headed beast. But we don't step on each other, and we orchestrate it in a way where we complement each other, and it's just this juggernaut of a sound.
Mm. So what are you guys going to be like as a live entity? Have you played any shows yet?
We did a one-off show where we sat in at a club and played a couple covers, but you could just tell on that one gathering that this band is going to explode when we rehearse and get together and play this live. It's going to be a five-ring circus. Everyone is a great performer visually and sonically on stage. And, you know, this band has octopus pedigree. We all have played major arenas and in major bands. There's major experience that is in Sons of Apollo, and we're going to bring all of that forward to the stage show.
Yeah. Will you be playing any stuff from your respective back catalogs as well with this band?
I mean, we haven't gotten there yet. For sure, we're going to play all of the record. All of us will have extended solo spots, and we'll inevitably have to play a couple of songs or their covers or stuff from the past. We're not sure yet, but whatever it is, it'll be great.
Yeah. I mean, it's really good for me to hear you and Mike playing together again. a little bit of my personal history. Falling Into Infinity was the very first album I ever reviewed in a magazine. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
20 years.
Yeah, long ass time. So, what was that time like for you joining that band? That must have been pretty intense.
It was very intense. I really didn't know who they were. And so when I got the music to learn for the audition, I was just going, holy shit, this stuff is pretty gnarly. But I looked at it as a challenge, and I really threw myself into it to prepare for the audition. And so when I went in, I figured I had a 50-50 shot. And surprisingly, I got the gig, and it all worked out from there. I never dreamed about playing in a progressive band. I always dreamed about playing in rock bands. I had Eddie Van Halen and David Lee Roth on my wall, not Steve Howe and John Anderson. Mm. So I looked at Dream Theater. It was a great opportunity to improve my musicianship. And also, I knew that if I could pull that gig off, that anything else in the future that I would encounter would be a piece of cake. Mm. And so I took the challenge on, and it was a great experience.
Well, that looks like nearly our time up. So thanks so much for the chat. The record's awesome, and I hope you guys make it down to Australia sometime next year.
Thank you so much. Psychotic Symphony out on Inside Out Records, Sony Music. You can follow all of our tour movements at sonsofapollo.com. Also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you on tour.
Thank you. I'll catch you soon. See ya.
This is the second time I've interviewed Lindy Ortega. The first was for Australian Guitar Magazine about 2 years ago to promote her album Faded Gloryville. And it was notable because my cat interrupted the interview by climbing into the pantry and meowing loudly, which he has never done before or since. It was really freaky. Anyway, earlier this year, Lindy released an EP called Till the Going Gets Gone. And she's heading down here to Australia for a run of shows, including the Queenscliff Music Festival. Visit lindyortega.com/tour for full dates and ticket info, and check it out.
So the first thing, of course, is woohoo, you're coming back to Australia. And I think it's great that you're doing two shows here in Melbourne. You're doing a couple of festivals. What can you tell me about your, I guess, relationship to Australia and previous experiences and stuff?
Well, I've always had a great time in Australia, and it's just the reason why I keep wanting to go back. So, I'm actually really looking forward to it. And really, you know what? It's the Tim Tams, I gotta say.
Oh, I can relate.
Me and my guitar player, I'm doing the tour with my guitar player, and last time we were there, we like, I don't know if you can overdose on Tim Tams, but I think we might have. And we just bought so many, and we kept doing the Tim Tam slam, and it was like our favorite thing in the world. So, and I know that my guitar player is a huge fan of Australian coffee. The coffee places in Australia are amazing. And, I'm happy to just go back and all the things I loved before I still love. I love your wildlife, and I love your accent. I keep trying to learn how to speak like you guys. I'm learning though.
My favorite thing is a lot of people from other countries have started to realize how hilarious it is when Australians say the word no, because there's a particular
no.
Yeah, and especially among like millennials, there's a particular twang to the no.
No. Well, I guess and so, like you're saying, I'm so sorry.
I've been listening to the new EP, well, since it came out, actually, but I wanted to ask you about the manner that you recorded it in, because I'm kind of always intrigued by stories of recording in, like, non-studio environments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was recorded at this place called Eastside Manor, and it was I don't know how to describe it. It's like a converted mansion that was like sort of converted into a studio. It was But it doesn't really feel, it didn't really have any sort of clinical studio feel to it whatsoever. And there were horses on the property. So it was like, it was a studio that was kind of like just outside of the city center, but you kind of felt like you were in the countryside because it was on quite a bit of land and there was a couple horses that you got to hang out with. And it was just like the coolest house. It was just really, really... It was such a great idea that the guy had to make this studio. So, but, you know, they had a vocal booth that I could have recorded in, but I discovered when I was going to the loo that there was lovely acoustics in the toilet. So I like, straight up recorded my entire EP from the toilet.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, I'm kind of always intrigued by how an environment, you know, affects a record. And you hear a lot of people say, you know, this is my New York record or my LA Sunshine record or whatever. I've never really thought about a toilet record before.
Well, you guys have heard of it as the Denny, right?
Yeah.
It's called the Denny in Australia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I know, it's kind of strange, but I'm told that other artists have, I'm not the first to sort of record a record from the toilet before, but it had a very high ceiling, so I liked the natural reverb. And the whole idea of the record was trying to make it as sound and natural as possible. Like, I didn't want to. I thought it would be cool to capture natural reverb as opposed to put heavy affected reverb on it for this record. Or for this EP, and the whole idea was to really strip down to basics and keep it really organic. So that's what I went and did with that.
Yeah.
That particular recording.
Cool. So I noticed on Facebook the other day you posted a little snippet of a song you wrote last week, and you said you were in a bit of a creative frenzy that day.
Oh my gosh, I'm having such a creative outburst right now.
Yeah.
Just, I've been very, very inspired. I was totally, I think, in a writing rut for a little while, because I had so many changes in my life. I sort of left my former label and management company and even my agent. So I went through a lot of changes, and then I acquired new management and new agent. I got engaged. I left Nashville. I moved to Calgary, Alberta, back to Canada. And then I had a very busy summer, and I'm getting married on the 29th of September. So I have been, just my brain has just been, like, dealing with all this change and all this stuff. Like, a lot of change happened in my life, so it was very hard for me to focus on new music and making a record and, like, even think about it. And I really kind of was nervous for a minute because I didn't know what I was going to do. And I know, like, I a record out next year, so the heat was on. It was like, okay, I've got to start coming up with songs and, like, figuring this whole thing out. But luckily, sometimes, like, writing one song sort of changes something for you. And I wrote a song, actually, with a friend of mine in Nashville, and it was sort of the catalyst for where I wanted to take the next record, and it was this grand epiphany. And then it just excited me beyond belief. So I'm so inspired, and I have so many ideas I can't wait to get stuck into. I've got a whole bunch of songs raring to go, and I'm still going to work on a few more and hoping to record, you know, at the end of the year and put something out next year.
Yeah, cool. Is it going to kind of follow in a bit of the sparse, you know, more sparse feel of the EP, or...?
I think it's not going to really follow in the footsteps of anything I've done before.
Yeah.
It will, I think, appeal very much to fans of my music, but it's not like anything I've done before.
Well, that's one of the really cool things about your style, is that you've done so many kind of angles on it. It always sounds like you, but it always sounds like a different, you know, a different facet.
Yeah, well, I have so many varied influences, and I think I just always draw from them, and I've never been, you know, a straight-up, like, country artist, you know, or anything, really. I had a little bit of blues, a little bit of soul, a little bit of roots and folk and what have you, so, yeah, I think people would expect of me to always explore new territory, and this is definitely a territory I had not fully explored before where I plan to go with this new record, but I am so into it and I'm so excited about it.
What are you playing at the moment?
I'm actually playing a Fender Paramount Deluxe guitar. And you know, I went into Fender. There's an office in Nashville, and I was actually over at the Schuller building that do my in-ears, or the office in there, because I had a little incident on an airplane with my in-ears getting kind of mangled, and they helped me out. And then in the same building as Fender, I'd gotten an email from the artist rep, who said that he was a fan and he wanted me to go into the Fender showroom, and if I wanted, I could try out some guitars and hang out and talk to them. I said, sure. I'm a huge fan of Fender as well. You know, I've always played Gibson, but I love a lot of the Fender electric guitars a lot. So who doesn't love the standard Telecaster and Strats and all that stuff? So I was excited to go in and talk to him. And at that point, they were just about to launch the Fender Paramount Deluxe, and he asked if I wanted to take one home and play around with that. So I did. And but before I left with it, I noticed that he had a guitar on the wall, and it said Nashville inlaid on the fretboard. And I said to him, man, it'd be so cool to have my name inlaid on the fretboard. And he turned around and said, well, we can do that for you. So I ended up going home and trying a guitar. And I thought it would just be a guitar that I would maybe use as just a songwriter guitar, because it's quite a small body. It's like a parlor size. And I thought, well, I could just maybe write some songs and take it to some, you know, co-writes or something, or whatever, travel with it easy. But I loved it so much, and I loved the sound of it so much that it ended up becoming my go-to, my main girl. So in place of all my expensive Gibsons. So and it's because I just love the sound, and I love the way it plays, and it just fits so well for me. So it's not because they've given me a guitar at all, because Gibson has also given me guitars, and like I said, I still will continue to always love Gibson as well, but this just, I don't know, this is my guitar. You know, I play it, I love it, and I don't think I'll trade it for anything.
Yeah. It's really cool how those smaller body guitars, like, the sound is, I think, more focused. It gives them more character. You know, I've got my original acoustic guitar that I got when I was 8, and it was probably made in the 60s or something. It's a piece of junk, but it sounds like nothing else, you know?
Yeah, it's incredible. I've heard so many stories of, like, people even buying sort of, like, a cheap whatever, like, guitar, and then they're like, yeah, this wasn't very expensive, but it's my favorite guitar, you know. So it's just like whatever speaks to people, or, you know, sometimes there's some guitars that are made, they must have been made magically or something. I played I think it's called a Fender Sonora or something. When I was in Spain, something happened with my guitar, so I had to borrow a guitar, and it was another Fender. It was a cool looking red one, and I loved it. I thought it was awesome, and it wasn't very expensive or anything like that, but I just thought it was such a cool guitar. So I mean, it's whatever speaks to you, really.
Do you have any kind of unique guitars or anything that you've collected, or
I used to want to acquire a bunch of guitars, but I've since decided to lighten my load and stop collecting because, well, we hang them all on our walls at home, so there's not very much wall room left. And between my fiance, he's also a guitar player, so he's got his guitars on the wall too, so there's just guitars everywhere. But yeah, I mean, there's a Gibson ES 195. I think it's an ES 195 or ES 95. It's a electric guitar with a big speed. It's got a Firebird headstock. It's really cool. And I got like a J200 cherry red with Everly pickguard, sort of custom made. That is really, it's so cool, and I really love it. But it's just so big and heavy to carry around on tour. So I usually play that when I'm playing like a home show, or like I don't have to travel too far or whatever. So those are probably my two faves.
Yeah, cool. What's it like living with another musician? I mean, my wife is a graphic artist, and, you know, so we're both creative in our own ways, but, you know, it's not like we're both trying to play at the same time or something.
Yeah, it's great because he's not like, he sort of splits his time between, he does like carpentry and renovations and stuff.
Wow.
He's a builder. So, but he also plays guitar for the singer from Canada, which is how we met. Such a long, weird story, but we are both Canadian, and we met in Franklin, Tennessee.
Yeah.
While I was writing songs with the guy that he plays guitar for, so it was kind of a funny encounter. But yeah, I mean, it's great. He actually was on the Chris Stapleton tour with me across Canada, so he actually played with me, and it was really nice to be on the road with him and spend time with him because, as you know, touring takes you away. And it's hard to be away from the person you love for a long time, but yeah, it's nice. I'm nothing but inspired by him. I think he's a beautiful guitar player and a beautiful singer and songwriter as well. So I always love hearing him play, and I'm always listening with a keen ear because I feel like I could learn from him.
Yeah.
I think he's fantastic.
All right, thanks for bearing with me with this cold here this week. It's been kind of difficult, but I got through it. So I'll catch you guys next week. I've got some super cool stuff coming up. Interviews lined up at the moment include Perry Ormsby to talk guitar nerd stuff about multi-scales and custom guitars and all sorts of things. We're also going to have Hartley Peavy on soon to talk about Peavy's return to Made in USA manufacture. And I've also got Kimberly Freeman coming up. Who else? I have a massive, like, ridiculous list of people who are going to be coming up soon. So keep an eye out. I might even end up making this twice weekly if you guys want to hear that much of me in your ears. So anyway, thanks for listening this week, and I'll catch you soon. Bye.